I'll add my welcome to those that have gone before, whether you're here every week, whether you're visiting from Minneapolis or from the Olympic Park or somewhere in between, you are very welcome. Please reach behind you to get a Bible from the pouches behind you. If you haven't got a Bible in the pouch behind you, please reach in front of you before the person in front of you reaches behind them. You can see up on that screen the passage we're looking at today, and even the page number, page 996. So please turn that up. And Claudia has taken off her apron and is going to come and read it to us. So over to Claudia. Please follow it as she reads. Please keep it open when she's done.
Do you mind, just on the topic of cooking, do you mind if we make a little noise, but keep the door open so we don't feel like we're missing everything. But we'll try and be quiet. But anyway, that's just from the kitchen. Right, okay.
I'll talk loudly.
Yes, please do. Right, so, parable of the tenants. He went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they'd give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him, and they sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but that one they also beat, and they treated shamefully, and they sent him away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. And then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard, and they killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, "God forbid." And Jesus looked directly at them and asked, "Then what is the meaning of what is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but anyone on whom it falls will be crushed." The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he'd spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people.
Great, thanks, Claude. Now, we're continuing this morning in the series that we've got on at the moment, running up to Easter and Jesus' death and resurrection. And the passages that we were looking at last week, we will be looking at in future weeks, are all taken from the days leading up to Jesus' death. So they're all looking forward to what's going to happen on Good Friday when Jesus dies and Easter Sunday when he rises from the dead. And this morning we have Jesus teaching a parable to show what his role is in God's plan. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with parables. A parable is a story with a special meaning. So although this story is about tenant farmers in a vineyard, Jesus is not talking about the rights and wrongs of agricultural husbandry. He's talking about something which is a meaning contained within the story. Now, people used to use parables in ancient times and fables to pass on meanings that they wanted to pass on. So I guess a good example would be the hare and the tortoise. Hands up if you've heard of the hare and the tortoise. Of course you have. Of course you have. Very famous story. So there's this hare and this tortoise. Rather unlikely that this should be so, but they're in a race. And the hare looks at the tortoise and thinks, "I'm going to win this race." So he shoots off. And he thinks, "Well, I've got so much time, I can have a quick nap." The hare has a quick nap. While the hare is asleep, the tortoise plods along, overtakes him, wins the race. What's the motto of the story? Well, if you're the hare, then make sure that you do the job properly and don't stop till it's done. If you're the tortoise, don't give up. It's a banal story. It's got a simple message, and everyone thinks, great, let's move on. Here in this passage, the story that Jesus tells is different. It causes offense. And it's clearly pretty loaded with meaning. Not all of that meaning is clear at first blush. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to a party, say a leaving do, for Bob from accounts, and someone gives a talk, and everything in the talk is an in-joke that only works if you know Bob from accounts for the last 3 years. Has anyone been to something like that? It's very tedious, very tedious. It's a bit like that here, in as much as it's not tedious, so I shouldn't have said that. But you need to know what Jesus is talking about. You need to know the meaning behind the meaning. Jesus tells a story about someone who owns a vineyard and whose tenants treat the owner and those he sends to collect the rent very badly. The landlord gets rid of the tenants and new ones are put in their place. So you might think, well, so what? Look at the reaction from the people listening to the talk. Look at verse 16 in that passage this morning. When the people heard this, they said, God forbid. Now, why did people think it was a bad idea for the owner of the vineyard to get justice against his tenants? Why did they react so strongly to a story about a vineyard? Have a look at verse 17. Jesus looked directly at them. This isn't just an interesting story to illustrate a wider message. Luke makes a point of saying in his gospel, Jesus looked directly at the crowd as if to say, listen, this is important. Hear what I'm saying. This is for you. And then verse 19, the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. So like the leaving party for Bob from accounts, it seems obvious to others what this means, but for us it needs a bit of breaking down, a bit of explanation. So here goes. So the first thing to notice is what the parable is about. It's about a vineyard. Now that's not a neutral term in those days. The moment that religious people in those days started speaking about vineyards, people knew they weren't just talking about where the nicest wine is made. This is a reference that everyone familiar with the Jewish scriptures would understand. To illustrate, I'm going to have a bit of an experiment here. Put up your hand if you did not grow up in the UK. Okay, very good. Keep your hand up. Keep your hand up, please. And keep your hand up if you know who a Scouser is. Okay, a few hands go down. Keep your hand up if you know who the Gunners are. Keep your hand up if you know who a Geordie is. Okay. Catherine, I'm going to see you as a bit of an exception because you grew up with an English family, but there we are. But the thing is, you know, most of us would know what these terms mean. A Scouser is someone from Liverpool. You know, Gunners are people who support Arsenal or who play for Arsenal. Geordie is someone from Newcastle. But otherwise, why would you know? If you grew up in Iran or Italy or the States, why would you know these things? You wouldn't know. It's something that Brits understand and other people may not understand. So it was when a religious figure in those days referred to a vineyard. The people in those days, certainly the religious leaders, would know their scriptures far better than we do today and would have been aware that when Jesus refers to a vineyard, he's talking about God's kingdom, about the people of Israel. This is what it says in the book of Isaiah, one of the Old Testament books, chapter 5. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. So when Jesus starts talking about a man who owns a vineyard, the people would have known that he meant God and that the vineyard was God's people. And when he talked about tenants in that vineyard, people would have known he meant the leaders of the people, which is why those religious leaders there knew that he told that story against them, because the story is about bad tenants. So let's break down what Jesus means in this parable. So the owner of the vineyard is God. He enters into an arrangement with some tenants in the vineyard. And those tenants are the people who are leading those in God's kingdom. Now, that arrangement between the owner and the tenants, that refers to the covenants or the agreements that God made with Israel, with his people, at various points in the Old Testament. And these covenants, these agreements, basically boil down to this. God agreed to be the God of Israel. That meant that he granted them success, that he blessed them, that he gave them land, and that they enjoyed his presence and his protection. That was his side of the bargain. Their side was they were to be his people. They were to give him what he is due, to worship him, to follow his commandments, to obey him. Now, in the same way that in the story, the owner sends messengers to the tenants, God sends messengers in the Old Testament to Israel. These are the people that we would call the prophets. And lots of the Old Testament, lots of the first bit of the Bible is written by them and about them. Now, these prophets don't have a good time. They remind God's people of his covenant with them and their duties to obey God. But God's people don't listen, and they go their own way. Just as the owner of the vineyard sends new messengers when the old ones are rejected, God still persists with his people. He sends new prophets. These again are the messengers sent second time, third time, by the owner of the vineyard in today's passage. And the tenants beat them up and send them away. The owner of the vineyard finally sends his beloved son in the hope that the tenants in the vineyard will treat the son better than all these messengers that have gone before. But instead, the tenants kill him in the hope they will get the vineyard as the people in possession. In the same way, God sends Jesus, his beloved son, and the religious leaders get the Romans to kill him. Jesus is saying to the religious leaders through this parable, the prophets that God sent in the past have been badly treated by previous religious leaders, and now you're about to kill me because I'm the son of the vineyard owner. I'm God's son. Killing me will have consequences, and God will judge you for your actions. No longer will God's kingdom be overseen by the Jewish religious leaders, but it will become available to others outside the people of Israel, to the non-Jews, to the Gentiles. Now, the Jews around Jesus realize that this is the meaning, and they're not happy. Their history has been one of God giving the people protection against outsiders, of God saving them from Egypt, giving them the promised land, and now he's going to hand his kingdom to outsiders. Verse 16, when the people heard this, they said, God forbid. In response, Jesus quotes from a psalm, verse 17. Look with me at that. Jesus looked directly at them and asked, then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. But this isn't a quote from just any psalm. This is when you need to use your fingers. Put your finger in Luke 20. Hopefully you've still got it open. And turn back to page 589 in your Bible. So 589, you will find Psalm 118, Psalm 118. Now, look at verse 26 of Psalm 118. For those of you who were here last week, you will remember it from the passage that Paul preached on. Verse 26 says, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And those of you who were here last week will remember how Jesus came into Jerusalem and the crowds were shouting this when he came in. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, the crowd were shouting words from a psalm, from Psalm 118. Why? Why were they doing that? Well, maybe because they expected Jesus to fulfill the rest of the psalm. Look at verses 10 to 12 of that psalm. This is what they say. All the nations surrounded me, but in the name of the Lord I cut them down. They surrounded me on every side, but in the name of the Lord I cut them down. They swarmed around me like bees, but they were consumed as quickly as burning thorns. In the name of the Lord I cut them down. Listen to those words. In the name of the Lord, I cut them down. Three times it says that. that sounds like a song of military conquest. And the Jews at that time were occupied by a hostile occupying power who were the Romans. So was Jesus the ruler that they'd been waiting for to rescue them from the Romans in the same way that God had rescued the Israelites from the Egyptians? They cried, Hosanna, as he rode into Jerusalem. Save us. But here, Jesus quotes another verse from the psalm. Look back at Luke 20. You can come out of Psalm 118 now. Look at Luke 20, verse 17. Jesus looked at them directly and said, then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. See, Jesus isn't going to be a military conqueror. He needs first to be rejected before he becomes the ruler that Psalm 118 talks about. He's not going to get the Romans. Instead, he's going to be rejected and crucified. He's going to disappoint the crowds that were cheering for him as he rode into Jerusalem. As Paul said last week, the cheering turns to jeering. They're cheering for him on the way into Jerusalem. They're jeering for him very shortly afterwards to be crucified. Why? He didn't meet their expectations. So what can we learn from this? Well, three things. And the first thing is maybe especially relevant for those of us who are new to the Christian message. Maybe you're hearing lots of this stuff for the first time. The Bible is in many ways a confusing book. There's this Old Testament, the first bit, full of strange stories and bloodshed. Then there's a New Testament, the second bit, where God seems to change his approach, and rather than have various people invade countries and kill lots of folk, he sends Jesus to die on a cross and make a way possible for us to be in heaven. Well, so far, so odd. It's tempting to see the two bits of the Bible as separate things. God does some stuff in the first half, then changes his mind and does different stuff in the second half. But the story that Jesus tells here directly links his death to what has gone before, what has happened in the Old Testament. You see, God sent the prophets in the Old Testament to turn the hearts of his people back to him. All the time in the Old Testament, prophets are saying, turn from your wickedness and turn back to God. That's what God wanted from his people, for them to stick to the covenants, these agreements that God had laid down, to worship and obey him as their God. God wanted to restore the relationship between him and his people. And God sends Jesus for exactly the same reason, to restore the relationship between him and mankind. Jesus is not God changing his mind. Jesus is God continuing to engage with mankind, through the prophets first, and now through Jesus. All through the Old Testament, God is reaching out to men and women to say, be my people. And all through the Old Testament, there are whispers, there are prophecies, there are rumors of one that will come to turn the hearts of men and women back to God. And Jesus comes to do just that. He is the fulfillment of what happened in the Old Testament. He's the person the Old Testament looks forward to. The Bible is not a collection of different stories. It's one story, how God rescued us from our wickedness and made a way open for us to be with him forever. Second thing is this. Looking at this story is pretty brutal. The tenants in the vineyard end up dead. But look how much patience the owner of the vineyard shows towards the tenants. Now, I've never let out any property in my life. Has anyone here let their house or is currently letting their house? One, two, three. Okay, a few people. So maybe if you go away for a long time, if you live overseas for a period, you might let your house out. Now, for those people who have done, are doing so, what would you do if the tenants in your property sent someone away that you'd sent to them beaten up? What would you do? What would you do? I imagine that would be the end of the tenancy. Is that fair to say? You let your house to someone. I mean, you know, rent collectors don't really operate these days in the way they used to. But someone comes about the property you beat them up and you send them away. That would be the end of it, wouldn't it? You'd send the cops round or you'd send someone else round and that would be the end of it. But look what happens here. The owner of the vineyard gives chance after chance for the tenants in the vineyard to pay him what he's due and eventually sends round his own son after all the other messengers had been badly treated. And the story of the Bible is that man keeps on messing up and messing up and messing up and rebelling against God and going their own way, but God keeps on giving man more and more chances to turn back to him. At any stage in history, God could have said, I've had it. I've had enough, and that would have been the end of the story of mankind. And for sure, there are periods where God punishes his people in the Old Testament for their wrongdoing, but he always stops short of saying, I'm going to end my experiment with man. The story here is of the owner of the vineyard being patient, being patient, being patient. He gives the tenants in the vineyard every opportunity to do what they were required to do, and only after they killed his son was the vineyard removed from them. God is a patient God. Finally, the third and most important thing, Andy's already touched on it. The owner of the vineyard doesn't take action against the tenants when they treat his messengers very badly, but when they kill his son, they are themselves killed. The tenants get their comeuppance because of how they treat the son of the owner of the vineyard. Jesus is the son of the owner of the vineyard. He is the son of God. Jesus is saying, how you deal with me is important because it will dictate what will happen to you. How we deal with Jesus will depend on what we think of him. So what do you think of Jesus? I'd like to show you a clip I found on YouTube. A film crew went to Washington Square Park in New York City and basically asked random members of the public what they thought about Jesus. So what you'll hear are these random members of the public saying what they think about Jesus. Listen and see if any of these chime with your own view.
Historical figure?
I don't know.
I think he was just a person. I don't know.
Just a normal person, like us.
He was a selfless person.
I have no clue. He was a man.
I think he was marketing genius because he got people to believe him.
I don't think he's the son of God. I don't believe that at all.
If David Copperfield was in the day of Jesus, he would be Jesus.
I'm pretty sure he existed. Like, I'm not going to say that he didn't exist.
He was God's son, but so was Gandhi, and so was Muhammad, and so was, you know, we're all God's children.
Jesus is someone I pray to.
Well, Jesus is my Lord and Savior, and he, to me, is the, like, symbol of just ultimate forgiveness and ultimate love. He's sort of that, like, constant figure in my life.
Jesus is also Isa in Arabic, and he was a messenger as well.
He was just extremely enlightened, like, religiously and morally.
Was somebody that just tried to impart wisdom on others and make the world a better place.
I think he saw something that a lot of people didn't see and still don't see in others. And I think that's just a lot of love and hope.
Jesus sort of seemed like an ominous figure. You know, he was God, and it was hard to relate to him. But I think as I've grown in my faith a lot, I've really started to see Jesus as my closest friend.
I wonder how many of those views match your own. Who do you see Jesus as? We've already seen how the crowds that were shouting for him when he rode into Jerusalem may have had the wrong picture of who he was. And I wonder if today many have the wrong picture of who he is. Turn back with me to Luke 20, look at verses 17 and 18. Jesus looked directly at them, it says, and asked, "Then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone on whom it falls will be crushed." Jesus is saying, I am the cornerstone. I'm going to be rejected, But if you reject me, it doesn't end well. You will be broken. You will be crushed. It doesn't sound like a nice teacher going around being lovely, does it? Now, the picture that Jesus paints is from architecture. Any architects in today? I'm not an architect either. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Now, I couldn't find a proper picture of what a cornerstone might look like in Jesus' time, but here's a picture of what it looks like now from Wikipedia. And this is the Wikipedia text beneath that picture on the Wikipedia page for cornerstone. This is what it says. The cornerstone or foundation stone or setting stone is the first stone set in the construction of a masonry foundation. All other stones will be set in reference to this stone, thus determining the position of the entire structure. Over time, a cornerstone became a ceremonial masonry stone or replica set in a prominent location on the outside of a building, like you can see there, with an inscription on the stone indicating the construction dates of the building and the names of architect, builder, and other significant individuals. Now, if you look at that picture, you will see, because you are observant, that the cornerstone doesn't look the same as the bricks around it. If you were going to build a building and you weren't an architect, if you weren't familiar with the building process, then what you would look for, I imagine, are bricks of the same size and shape, broadly speaking, because it's obvious how they fit together. You might look at the cornerstone and think, what am I going to do with that? But you reject the cornerstone at your peril, because like it says in that Wikipedia entry, it's the stone by reference to which all the other stones are set in place. Without that stone, the building loses its structure, and I imagine, it's likely to fall down. It's out of shape compared to the other bricks, and it's crucial. Back in Jesus' time, people were looking for a leader to drive out the Romans, but Jesus didn't fit that shape. He was out of shape compared to what the people wanted. Now, today, of course, we don't have an occupying force like they did back then. So what do people want from Jesus today? Well, one consistent theme, I thought, from those interviews in that YouTube clip was this. Various people thought Jesus was a good man with maybe particular wisdom or insight, that he was loving and accepting of people, or that he had special skills. I thought there was a good deal of respect shown to Jesus in that clip and to who he might have been. And that chimes with what I hear in London today. Lots of folks that I speak to would look to Jesus as someone who is nice, who is kind, who is loving, who never judges anyone, but is entirely loving, entirely accepting of everyone. Now, it seems to me from my friends, from my neighbours, that the ultimate goal of lots of people today is self-fulfillment, living your best life now. And people accept Jesus to the extent he doesn't get in the way of that. They put Jesus in a box that's labelled good man that allows me to do whatever I want to do. But Jesus doesn't fit into that box. He was out of shape compared to what the people wanted when he walked the earth then, and he's out of shape compared to what people want today. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this sermon series looks forward to Jesus' death when he took the spot that was rightly ours in being punished, not for his own wrongdoing, not for his own rebellion, not for his own sin, but for ours. Let me ask, have you taken on board today how much of an insult that is to you? How much of an insult that is to you? Why? Because Jesus came to the earth to pay the price for the things we've done wrong. That means none of us, not you, not me, is good enough on our own to stand before God. Have you taken that insult on board? It's a loving insult. We might think of ourselves as kind and generous and lovely, but Jesus says, no, you're not good enough. Jesus says, only by me, only by Jesus taking your punishment can you stand before God, because only by me, only by Jesus taking your punishment is justice served. And if we want to follow Jesus, what does he say we have to do? Well, Jesus said this in the Gospel of Matthew, one of the other books of the New Testament. He says this, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." It's not about saying my life is about doing all the things I want to do. Jesus is love and he will accept me whatever happens. What does Jesus say? He says we need to accept that we're not good enough. Accept that we need to be rescued from the consequences of our sin and rebellion against God. Come and follow Jesus and deny ourselves. If we don't, well, Jesus says in this morning's passage, I am the cornerstone around which everything else is built. If you reject me as I am rather than who you want me to be, then you will fall on that cornerstone and be broken and crushed. That may be a hard message to hear. It's what the Bible says. The tenants in the vineyard were judged by how they dealt with the son of the owner of the vineyard. We will be judged by how we deal with Jesus, the son of the owner of the vineyard, the Son of God. If we reject the Jesus of the Bible because he's out of shape compared to who we want him to be, then we will be rejected by Jesus and broken and crushed. If we follow Jesus and do as he says, then by his death on the cross, we have the great good news that we will be accepted by God as his dearly loved children and be granted eternal life. God will reject us if we reject Jesus. God will accept us if we follow Jesus. Everything depends on how we react to Jesus.